And this is Benjamin Chadwick, and he is going to be presenting some of the slides. He's one of our research assistants and is a very talented young man. He's with the UCLA Department of Family Medicine. And in the audience, we have Dr. Lillian Gelberg, who's the PI on our study, and we have Lisa Arangua right there, who is the director of our project. So what we're going to be discussing today is improving follow-up among low-income urban patient populations. And we're with the UCLA Department of Family Medicine. I have no relationships to disclose. So to put in context what we're going to be discussing, as many of you might know, follow-up among this population, the low-income and homeless populations in urban areas, can be incredibly difficult in the health setting and research setting. And what we know through past research is that there is a positive association between treatment outcome and follow-up. So the better the follow-up, the better the treatment outcome, and this is why it's so relevant and important. Surprisingly, there's really limited amount of research on follow-up and retention among the low-income and homeless populations. In fact, there's hardly any that really focuses just on this subject. Studies often exclude this population because they are so difficult to follow up, and can be much more expensive. And practically very difficult, which limits many studies' generalizability. As well, studies that just focus on this population that do have really significantly high follow-up rates do not discuss the methods or performed any evaluations to see what improves follow-up among these difficult populations. And so what we did is we took data. We have a large pilot study going on in the LA area, and in fact it's going to become bi-national soon as well in Mexico, so it's really exciting. And what we do is it's called the Quit Using Drugs Intervention Trial, and it's a randomized control trial of a ESPERT protocol, which is screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. And it involves a very brief primary care clinic-based intervention compared to usual care in the risky drug use in low-income populations. And we're at the data that we are taking for this presentation is from 4 federally qualified health centers in the LA area. And our patient population are adult patients with a primary care visits at these clinics. And recruitment, basically we approached all patients in these waiting rooms with primary care visits to see if they would qualify for our study. So takeaway from this slide, our study procedures, just basically what is necessary for our follow-up in this study. So for our experimental condition, at baseline, we meet them at their first office visit. We enroll them. And we have a 2-week and a 6-week health education session, which is actually based on motivational interviewing. And that's over the phone. And then we have them come in, or we meet them somewhere that's convenient for them for their 3-month follow-up. For our usual care, we don't do the motivational interviewing over the phone. We just have them come in for their 3-month follow-up. So total follow-up for our study is 3 months. And Benjamin is going to present this slide.
So looking at the demographics of the enrolled subjects that we're including in this presentation, that we looked at up till May of 22nd. It's relatively diverse in terms of the age, gender, and racial ethnicity. And when we look at the income, 75% are a very low income, and so it further representing our population. And moving on to sleeping location that they reported the previous night, when you add up the numbers or the percentages, 65% are marginally housed or homeless, which shows that our population is predominantly very low income and homeless or marginally housed.
So initially, what were our follow-up strategies? We had a financial incentive, $30 at baseline and then $50 at follow-up. At baseline, we would have them fill out a recontact form with their email address and 1 phone number. And if we were unable to contact them during those 3 months, we would often try to contact them with their follow-up appointments in the clinics. We initially started off with just a part-time presence of study staff in the clinics, and we soon realized that we needed a full-time community person, and we hired a full-time community health worker who served as our follow-up coordinator and health educator. And this is really significant because you'll see how this really improved follow-up. The other function of this person, once we realized later on that our follow-up rates weren't what they needed to be, is we had him work significantly on our recontact form, and I'll discuss that in a minute. So, like I said, initially we were experiencing low retention rates for our 3-month follow-up, and possible explanations that we came up with was that it's generally a low-income population, and many were very transient. We would actually even see in different counties see patients at our various clinics coming to them at different times. I mean, they were really moving around a lot. Sometimes we'd call them, and they'd move to different states. Oftentimes, we found that they would go to rehab. Some of our patients ended up in jail. Many just were without stable housing. Some patients had significantly increased their substance use during the follow-up period, and for different reasons that made it difficult for us to recontact them. And a huge issue was that because of their financial situation, they didn't have long-term or enduring phone numbers. They had prepaid phones. They wouldn't pay their phone bills, and so the initial number they gave us oftentimes wasn't relevant 3 months later. Many patients missed their follow-up appointments that they had scheduled at baseline, and we couldn't recontact them that way. And importantly, the recontact forms weren't helpful because sometimes the patients wouldn't provide us with accurate information. There might have been a general distrust of research because of the nature of the study, or they just didn't complete them entirely. So what we did is we assembled a working group that met weekly to discuss our follow-up procedures. Methodological changes were implemented based on these findings, and then these are what I'll call strategic protocol changes. And then what we did is we calculated the on-time and the 3-month follow-up assessment retention rates for each strategic protocol that we made to see how they really made a difference in terms of follow-up. And the reason we did on-time instead of total is because we really wanted the best follow-up we could for patients. And so if we couldn't get in touch with them in 3 months, we got in touch with them in 6 months, we would still get that information from them because that was important, but it didn't necessarily reflect the protocol change that was made at the time. And so what we wanted to do was figure out a way we could really reflect that protocol change. And so that meant that it was only the on-time protocol changes that were made. And so we defined that as within 6 weeks of the 3 months that they were due. The purpose of our study was really to evaluate the methodological changes made during the QUIT study, and this in hopes of improving follow-up among longitudinal studies and or follow-up among primary safety net clinics in low-income and homeless populations. So Ben is going to present this slide.
So just to give a visual example of when we implemented protocol changes and when we were at the various clinics. So Clinic A is sort of our baseline or pre any protocol changes. And as you can see, as soon as we went into Clinic B, we implemented Protocol Change 1. And then when we entered Clinic C, we implemented Protocol Change 2 at Clinic B and C, which we were both present at. And then when we went into Clinic D following that, we implemented our Protocol Change 3, which, as you can see, we implemented at all the clinics we were present at that time.
So just briefly, and I'll go into these in more detail a little bit later, the 3 protocol changes we made is we improved our recontact form. The research assistant was made responsible for filling out the recontact form, and follow-up appointments were made and documented at enrollment. The second one is we hired a full-time community-based follow-up coordinator / health educator. So initially we had one health educator, but he only stuck with us for a short period of time and then left. So there was a span in between that we didn't have that position, and we had to rehire them because we realized how integral they were to follow-up. So we hired them towards the end, you'll see. So strategic protocol change one, what we did was we really beefed up our recontact form, and we included a primary and secondary number. We included a mailing address, a home address, living situation, social or caseworker information, emergency contact number, and institutions where this patient might receive medical care. And we implemented this at clinics B, C, and D, so anything after the protocol change was made, all of the clinics received this recontact form. And I'll just tell you now that we probably contacted patients, each one of these protocol each one of these additions made, we probably contacted a patient using one of these, using this information. So what we see here, and I'll explain this slide, it might be confusing at first, is pre-change. So what we did is we did 3-month follow-up rates, pre-change and post-change. Pre-change, we see it was actually higher, 68%, for both the control and intervention. And post-change, it was lower at 46% and 38%. And so when we were looking at these numbers, we thought, okay, what happened here? And what happened was we lost our full-time community health worker. And this community health worker was quite involved within the community that we were working. He actually lived in the community in a homeless shelter there and was working with us. And so we found this huge drop in the numbers. Additionally, though we added all this information into the recontact forms, patients weren't filling them out completely still. And so we weren't gaining that information. And so you'll see a huge drop here. So then we went on to talk a little bit more and made some more strategic protocol changes. And then we'll discuss these.
So after recognizing that issue with protocol change 2, we had the RA be responsible for filling out these recontact forms with the patient so that we could not only have a more trusting relationship by further engaging with the patient, but also to be able to probe for more information so that the patient isn't hurriedly just going through it quickly just to get it done, but we're actually getting the information that we need to be able to contact them once again in 3 months. And then the second change we made was we, along with protocol change two, was we scheduled these 3-month follow-up appointments when we enrolled them, because previously we would call them a week before 3 months came due and then start working with them from there, seeing when would work with them. But by doing this, we also gave them a laminated sheet which had the date of it as well as the faces and numbers of our health coordinators. And what we saw was that these people, when we came to contact them again, they would often have these laminated sheets with them still. They would be saying, sometimes they would even be calling themselves first to make sure that they would be on time with this appointment. And so we believe it really made patients feel like an integral part of the study because they were putting more effort into it and, you know, keeping these sheets. And as you and as you saw earlier, this protocol change was implemented at clinics C and D.
And so what we saw here is before this protocol change and after an increase in 3-month on-time follow-up for control, 46% to 67%, and for intervention, 38% to 52%. So for the last protocol change we made, which we initially had this position filled and then lost him soon thereafter. So we rehired a full-time community-based follow-up coordinator and health educator. And the role of this person was really to increase community collaboration by enhancing relationships with local shelters and homeless resources, to increase daily contact and communication with patients, and to be able to more readily accommodate their schedules. And it really allowed staff time to meet patients in homeless shelters, homes, parks, community centers, and rehab facilities. So by being in the clinic every single day, you just became a recognizable person in the community. Oh, that's the person from the study. I remember them. Or you just began to recognize the patients. This was one of my roles, and I started to really recognize the patients in the study, and you just started to really become known within this community in the clinic because patients would often come back and talk with you. As well, the important part of this was just really enhancing community connection. So this was implemented, as we know, in Clinics A, the initial clinic, and Clinic D, the last clinic. And we saw an increase in follow-up rates, 67% to 70%, and 52% to 58% for the intervention. So once all of these protocol changes were implemented, we just saw an upward trend in follow-up rates being completed on time. So the three in summary were the full-time health educator / coordinator and community worker, the accurate and detailed recontact information, which is made possible by really forming these trusting relationships with patient and staff. We'd really have them sit down and kind of discuss the importance of why we needed their contact information. And then making the follow-up appointments scheduled and documented at enrollment. And many of these protocol changes were patient-centered. And what we hope is that further research is done in this area so that we could really improve follow-up rates among this population and hopefully be able to include them in larger studies. Because as we know, the more follow-up we have, the better the treatment outcome is for these patients, and that's why it's so incredibly important. And perhaps maybe other studies might want to adopt some of our strategies for improving follow-up among this population. Thank you so much. That's an interesting one. I hadn't thought of that. We did think of Facebook. There was an issue with HIPAA. So having follow-up among patients and using Facebook, we couldn't figure out how to make it HIPAA compliant. So that was one of the issues. If anybody has any ideas for the future, that would be fantastic, and how we could use Facebook, because that's a huge way. I mean, a lot of our patients, interestingly, when I would ask them for more information, they would say, well, I have Facebook. You could contact me via Facebook, but that would really violate the HIPAA law. We did have packets that we gave patients, information packets, that were colorful and did have some branding, but we didn't have any, you know, kind of the hand sanitizers or anything like that we gave out, but that's an interesting idea. Yeah. Yes?
Talking about having a community health worker / what did this person look like? As in, was it someone in the community? Was it a chest-prepared health educator?
Was it a what?
What did this person look like?
So the person, they asked what the person looked like who is the community health worker, health educator. So the first person we had was living in the community and was hired onto the study. We had trained health educators who were trained in motivational interviewing and who would, their position was really to do the follow-up coordination, so call people at 2 weeks, 6 weeks, and 3 months, and do the health education sessions, as well be more integrated within the community so that if we were having a hard time reaching people, we can say, oh, do you know where might be a good place to find these, you know, we're having a really hard time finding this person, do you know where might be a good place, without using names. So they were really involved within the community in homeless shelters, discussing with case managers, things like that.
Okay, my concern on that, and I'm going
to... Yeah, yeah, yeah.
...for anyone who will listen. You call that community health worker also a health educator?
Yeah.
That's like someone who's taking first aid saying, I'm a physician. It is a control term. Community health worker is an incredibly powerful professional that we don't use enough. Sorry, that's my own soapbox. But they're not a health educator. They're a community health worker who does great work. You don't want to call them a health educator if they're not, if they don't have their degree in health education, and have a pass or chest and all that.
Okay.
It's a board certified term. Well, this helped, and I got one. This helped educator, I'm a member on this team. I mean, he was an interesting guy. He was from London, he had an MA, he lived in the community. He may have lived in the community because he had come out from London. But we trained him as, because he had a master's in counseling. And so we needed a health educator on board as well. So he served two roles. So, because we needed to fill that space as well. So he had a personal relationship. He had a counseling skill, so
right.
Obviously we're going to utilize that.
Well, I'm not saying he wasn't a valuable person. It sounds like he was incredibly valuable. It's just a title.
Got it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's an important thing with a title.
Right.
Got it. Thank you. Yes.
You may have mentioned this, I didn't hear. The clinics in which
In the Los Angeles area, in L.A.
But specifically, were they in academic medical centers?
Oh, no, they were safety net community clinics.
Community.
Yeah, some were, one was in Skid Row downtown. They were mostly for the uninsured. One was in Venice, Long Beach area.
Community health
centers. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. So the question was if there's any clinics that we found in our literature review or research of clinics who had really, really good follow-up rate, who didn't have the ability to have financial incentives and things like that. We actually didn't look into clinics, and that would be a really good idea. I know that there are clinics out there, and one of the ways that people are improving follow-up right now is actually a different form of media is through texting. And so one of the ways I know that clinics are improving follow-up, there was a recent study in New York, is by texting patients to remind them of their follow-up appointment, and that seems to be kind of a new mode of communication for follow-up, and that has significantly improved follow-up among clinics. Any other questions? Yes. So we had 2 full days of motivational interviewing training that was done, designed by one of our physicians who is an expert in motivational interviewing and drug addiction. And we did a lot of, first there was like the explanation and learning of motivational interviewing, and then we did a lot of role playing. So we did a lot of case scenarios, and then we would have, some boosters, or we would, and then every week we would have a meeting in terms of how these motivational interviewing sessions are going, and we would get feedback from experts of what we could have done better or what we could have. So every week we were kind of being retrained in terms of motivational interviewing and what it looks like and how we could be doing it better. And those were over the phone. Those were phone meetings that lasted about an hour to 2 hours a week. And we would present each case of health education that week. Any other questions? Okay. Thanks for allowing me to be here.